There are occasions in a hunter's experience when a spore begins hot and true and then fades. Mark remembered a hunt like that which he and the old man had made up near Charker's Gate. "Dead spore, gone away," he muttered aloud now, and stood uncertainly in the main street of Ladyburg. There seemed no way that he might find the old man's grave, no way that he could bring the body back and rebury it beside Alice on Andersland. Less important was the money that the old man had been paid for Andersland. £3,000, it was a vast fortune in Mark's eyes, and it would be good to know what had happened to it. With that amount he could afford land of his own somewhere. Then Mark faced the issue he had avoided up until now, and admitted that there was just one more faint chance, but he felt his stomach tighten at what he had to do. With a physical effort he steeled himself and set off steadily down the street towards the towering building of the Ladyburg Farmers' Bank. He had not reached it before the church clock on the spire at the end of the street sounded the hour. Five clear chimes that echoed across the valley, and a dozen bank employees came out in a group through the front door, smiling and chatting gaily in the relief of the day's work ended, while a uniformed guard began closing and locking the solid mahogany doors. Mark felt a sneaking sense of relief, and he turned away. "I'll come back tomorrow," he told himself firmly. The boarding-house behind the church offered dinner and a bed for 7 shillings and 6p, and Mark thought about it for only a moment. The sovereigns that he had from the old man's hoard might have to carry him long and far. He went on out to the bridge over the Bebuenström and climbed down onto the bank, moving upstream to find a place to camp. There was a fine sight, with trees and firewood 1/4 mile above the bridge. But when Mark went down the bank to the water, he could smell the stink of it before he touched the surface with the canteen. He paused, squatting on his haunches. There was a thick soapy scum thrown up along the edge, and it had coated the stems of the reeds. For the first time, Mark realized that the reeds were dead and brown, and that the water bubbled with sullen beads of gas. He scooped a handful and sniffed at it, then flicked it away with disgust and stood up, wiping his hand on the seat of his pants. There was a big yellow fish, at least 4 pounds in weight, its swollen belly upwards, and rotting opaque eyes bulging from its head as it floated in the sluggish current, turning gently in the eddy at the edge of the reeds. Mark watched it with a feeling of disquiet, of foreboding, as though that poisoned and rotting carcass had some special significance in his life. He shuddered softly and turned away, climbed the bank again, and shouldered his pack. He made his way upstream, pausing now and then to peer down into the riverbed, until he was opposite the steel structure of the new sugar mill. Here the waters of the stream boiled and steamed with wisps of pale gas that hung like mist in the stiff brown reeds. Around the next bend he came upon the effluent pipe, a 6-inch black iron pipe that stuck out over the far side of the bank, from which the hot, steaming discharge poured in a continuous stream. A change in the breeze carried the acrid chemical stench of it to where Mark stood, and he coughed and turned away. 100 yards further upstream, the clear water chuckled through clean stands of green reeds that bowed and swung gracefully on the breeze, and Mark saw the deep waving shape of an eel in the pool beyond, and watched the small black and pink crabs scurrying across the sugar-white sand below the surface. He found another campsite, on the first slope of the escarpment, beside a waterfall and its slowly swirling pool. In the trees above him, the ferns hung like soft green veils, and when he stripped his clothing and went into the pool, the water was a cool and refreshing delight. He shaved with the old cutthroat, sitting naked on a mossy rock beside the pool. He dried himself on his shirt, and then rinsed it out and hung it beside the small bright fire to dry. And while he waited for the canteen to boil, he wandered, bare to the waist, onto the open slope and looked down into the valley. The sun was already touching the rim of the escarpment, and its low rays were ruddy and warm. They burnished the iron roofs of the town and tinted the column of smoke that rose from the chimney stack of the sugar mill to a beautiful golden bronze. The smoke rose tall into the evening sky, for the breeze had dropped in that peculiar stillness and hush of the African evening. Movement caught his eye, and he blinked to clear his vision. There was a hunting party in the open land beyond the town. Even at this distance, Mark could tell they were hunters. four horsemen moving slowly in a group, one with a rifle or shotgun held against his hip, its barrel pointing to the sky as he leaned forward intently in the saddle. The other three were armed also. He could see the guns in the scabbards at their knees, and they also had the intent air of suppressed excitement, the air of the hunter. Ahead of the group was a single figure, a Zulu in ragged cast-off Western clothing, but he led the horsemen in the characteristic attitude of the tracker, trotting in that deceptively fast gait of the Zulu, head down, eyes on the ground, carrying a stripped reed in one hand, the tracker's wand to part the grass or touch the spoor. Idly, Mark wondered what they were hunting, so close to town, and on the bank of that dying and poisoned river, for they were coming along the same trail that Mark had followed to the escarpment. The light was going swiftly now. The shining beacons of the iron roofs winked out swiftly as the sun went below the crest. But in the last of the light, Mark saw the leader of the group of horsemen rein in his mount and straighten in the saddle. He was a stocky figure, sitting square on his mount. The man looked upwards towards the escarpment where Mark stood. Then the light was gone, and the group became a dark blob against the darkening land. Vaguely disturbed and troubled by the day just past, by the cold memories of the old man, by the sadness of that dying river, and at last by that distant figure, Mark crouched over his fire, munching his stew of tinned bully, and then sipping his coffee. When at last he pulled on his coat and rolled into his blanket, close beside the fire, he could not sleep. The sense of disquiet seemed to grow rather than abate, and he found himself wondering again what four horsemen could find to hunt on the edge of a busy town. Then he thought again about the way that they had followed his own path along the river, and the disquiet deepened. Sleep receded. Suddenly he remembered how the old man would never sleep beside his cooking fire.
"I learned that when we was chasing the boar. A light in the night brings things other than moths, lions, hyenas, and men."
He could almost hear the old man's voice saying it, and he rose immediately with the blanket still around his shoulders and moved away up the slope 50 yards until he found a hollow filled with dead leaves. Sleep came at last, and the soft skirt of it was falling lightly across his eyes when a scops owl called in the forest near him. Instantly he was fully awake. It was a familiar night sound, but this one had jarred some deep chord in him. The imitation had been clever, but it did not deceive an ear so closely tuned to the sounds of the wild. Tense and listening, Mark lifted his head slowly and peered down the slope. His fire was a puddle of pink embers, and above him the shapes of the trees were dark and fluffy against a crisp sky of white stars. The owl called again down near the pool, and at the same moment Mark heard something move stealthily near him in the darkness, something big and heavy, the brush, brush of footfalls in the dead leaves. Then there was silence again. Mark strained his eyes and ears into the darkness, but it was impenetrable under the trees. Far below in the valley a locomotive whistled three times, the sound carrying clearly in the stillness. And then there was the huff and puff of the train pulling out from the goods yard and settling into a steady rhythmic beat of boiler and tracks. Mark tried to put that sound beyond his hearing, trying to filter it out so that he could discern the closer, softer sounds in the night around him. Something moved down the slope. He heard the silky, soft whisper of it, and then he saw movement outlined against the glowing ashes of his fire. A man's booted legs stepped out of the darkness and halted beside the fire, standing completely still. Nearer Mark, there was another movement, a stir of impatient feet in dead leaves, and then unmistakably the metallic snick of gunmetal as a safety catch was slipped to the fire position. The sound struck like electricity along Mark's nerve ends, and his breath caught in his throat. It was very close, 6 feet away, and now he thought he could make out the loom of the man against the stars. He was standing almost on top of Mark's bed in the hollow, staring down at the fire beside the camp. The man at the fire spoke now softly, but his voice carried clearly.
"The bastard's gone. He's not here."
He stooped to the pile of dry firewood that Mark had cut and stacked. He threw a piece onto the embers, and sparks flew upwards in a fiery spiral, and the branch flamed, throwing out a circle of yellow light. Then he exclaimed sharply, "Is Pack still here?" And he hefted the shotgun expectantly, glaring into the night. "Remember, there's £100 on it." The words and the way the men were handling the shotgun made his intention clear beyond doubt. Mark felt the warm flood of adrenaline rush through his body, and he was poised and quivering with suppressed energy, ready to burst into explosive movement in an instant. The man near him moved again, and Mark heard the muted tap of metal on metal, the sound of the man's breathing also, hoarse with tension. And then suddenly, and with devastating shock, bright white light split the darkness. A lantern beam swiveled and then fastened on Mark's blanket-wrapped crouching form. In the instant before he moved, Mark saw the shape of the man beyond the dazzle of the light. He carried the lantern in his right hand, holding it high, at the level of his head, and the rifle was in his left hand, hanging at the trail. He was completely unprepared to find Mark lying almost at his feet, and his shout was wild. "He's here, my God!" He tried to bring up the rifle, but his right hand held the lantern. "Shoot! Shoot, damn it!" another voice shouted, the voice somehow familiar. And beside Mark, the man dropped the lantern and began to swing up the rifle. Mark launched himself straight at him. He used the man's own momentum, taking the upswing of the rifle, seizing the muzzle of the barrel in one hand and the stock in the other. He smashed the weapon into the man's face with the full weight and force of his body behind it. He heard gristle and bone crunch, while the solid impact of the steel breech striking into the man's face was transmitted through the rifle into his arms, jarring him to the shoulders. The man went over backwards with a cry that bubbled with the quick burst of blood into his nose and mouth. Mark bounded over him and ran up the slope. Behind him there was a chorus of shouts and cries, and then the blam, blam, blam of a shotgun, and the double glow of the muzzle flashes. Mark heard the heavy charges of shot slash into the leaves beside him, and something burned his upper arm like the sting of a wild bee. "The light! Get the light, man! There he is! Don't let him get away!" A rifle fired three times in quick succession. It sounded like a .303 Lee Enfield. The bullet hit a rock and howled away into the sky. Another thumped into a tree trunk close beside him as he ran. Mark fell heavily in the dark and felt his ankle go. The pain of it exploded up his leg into his groin and lower belly. He rolled onto his knees and the beam of the lantern swept over and then fastened hungrily on him. "We've got him!" A fusillade of shots and a triumphant chorus of shouts. The shots and bullets shattered the air around him, one so close that the whip of it deafened one ear, and he threw himself forward at the slope. The pain in his foot made Mark cry out. It was white-hot shooting agony that burst from his ankle and broke like brilliant phosphorescent surf against the roof of his skull. But he drove himself on, soaked with sweat, swerving as he ran, sobbing and hobbling on the damaged leg. They were spread out in the bush behind him, and it seemed that the slope was tiring them quickly, men accustomed to riding horseback, for the cries were becoming strained and breathless, edged with worry and the first fear that their quarry might escape them. Mark was trying to think between the bursts of agony with which each step racked him. He thought to drop into thick cover and lie until they passed him, but they were too close for that, and they had a tracker with them, a tracker who had brought them unerringly to his camp even in darkness. To lie down now would be surrender and suicide, and he could not go on much longer. Already the pain was threatening to swamp him. There was a sound in his head like great wings, and his vision was starting to break up and star. He fell to his knees and vomited, gagging and choking on the acid gall of it, and within seconds the voice of the pursuit was closer and more urgent. He dragged himself up, and the lantern beam caught him squarely. A rifle bullet disrupted the air about his head, so that he staggered as he blundered onwards, using the screen of bush to avoid the beam of light.